Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today, where we're going to be welcoming Dr. Quentin Wheeler, who is still the relatively new president of SUNY ESF, new to us. First, though, I'd like to remind you about programs that we have coming up for the next couple of weeks in February. Next week, we're going to be talking housing. We're going to get an update from Caitlin Wright, who's the director of the Land Bank. You remember she was here about a year ago. A lot has happened since then, and she's going to be joined by Carrie Quaglia from Home Headquarters, and they are doing great things all around the city and the county, actually, with vacant properties. So that's next week, and then the following week, Dominic Robinson is going to be with us, also Meg O'Connell, who is the chair of the Work Train Collaborative. And you'll be hearing a lot about that, which is a training program for low-skilled workers, train them for jobs that are sorely in need of employees in the area. So two really interesting talks coming up. Also wanted to tell you about one more thing before we get started. And that is a new program that's going to have a trial run next Tuesday, February 17th. And that, we're calling it Civics on Tap. It's sort of kind of an informal TMR, but it's after hours, after work. And it's in a place where there might be a tap or two, but anyway. So next Tuesday, February 17th, we're debuting it at the Incomplete, which is the old ski lodge on South Campus. Some of you might remember that. And we're going to be talking with Dave Proak, who is the director of IT for the city of Syracuse. And we're going to be hearing about municipal broadband, why it's intriguing, the mayor's plans. And so I'll send you all an email about it. It's on our Facebook pages, and I highly recommend it. It's a new thing. I'm going to check it out. Civics on Tap. But right now, I'm going to ask Tom Buckle. Some of you might remember Tom, an erstwhile TMR member, who is also a member of the SUNY ESF Board of Trustees, to introduce today's guest speaker. Thank you, Tom.
Good morning. This seems like a suitable day to think of the environment and talk about it. And it's my pleasure to introduce the fourth president of the State University College of Environmental Science and Forestry, Dr. Quentin Wheeler. We know the college, of course, as ESF. And briefly, Dr. Wheeler earned his PhD from Ohio State University. And as he reminds us often, they are the national champions in football. After he earned his PhD, Dr. Wheeler joined the faculty at Cornell University, where he stayed and taught for about 20 years. So he's certainly no stranger to our area. After Cornell, Dr. Wheeler joined the faculty and became dean of Arizona State University, where he presided over a department, I think 17,000 students or 20,000 students. And after a very in-depth, extensive search, Dr. Wheeler was recommended to the chancellor by the Board of Trustees and the faculty, and was clearly a favorite, and he earned it. Dr. Wheeler is a prolific author. He is an expert in entomology, for I had to learn what that was. It's the study of bugs and species. And in these times, Dr. Wheeler reminds us often that, as Jefferson used to say, public education, public universities are the cornerstone of a democratic republic. Dr. Wheeler's vision takes that a step further, however. Today, in the light of the challenges we face, in light of the very survival of the various species and the planet, the public university today stands at a place where to maintain its role as a democratic republic, it has to solve the most pressing challenges of our time. It must lead the way in bringing science to the public sphere to deal with some of the most vexing challenges that put our own survival at risk. And with that, to share his vision with you, I am very proud and happy to introduce Dr. Wheeler.
Well, good morning. After 7 years in Phoenix, I'm still getting used to what I see when I walk out the door in the morning, but it is all coming back to me. We are facing environmental challenges in number, in scale, and complexity, unlike anything humans have ever faced before. It really is unprecedented. And so this century calls for a different approach to these things. And I'll rattle through a laundry list of some of the environmental challenges we're facing. This is not an exhaustive list, but it does hit some of the ones that should be causing us some of the most concern. Perhaps the one we read most about in the popular press is climate change. And the uncertainties of climate change are so numerous that it is frightening. The implications for agriculture, the lands that we've been blessed with such productive agricultural land in North America, and it's not yet clear what the implications will be to climate change on the productivity of that land. And in areas like I lived in the valley in Arizona, the prospect of climate change, I had never seen 118 degrees before, and I can't imagine seeing anything much higher than that and surviving. And so, people think a lot about global warming in Phoenix. There are concerns about the stability and the security of our access to energy, to food, and to water, of course. There are so many of our natural resources that are either immediately threatened with depletion or certainly in the long term, measured in decades. And that's everything from, if you think about it, fisheries to fossil fuels are things we need to be worried about. As you look around the world, the degradation of ecosystems is really frightening. The natural systems that have sustained life on this planet for billions of years are shrinking in size, diminishing in quality, and in general are being degraded, which again makes it uncertain. And at some point, these systems are not self-sustaining if you assault them enough times. When they're biologically diverse, it's like a diverse economy. You can hit one part of it, and there's enough resilience in the system to bounce back. But if you degrade them enough, there is a tipping point at which that resilience disappears. Another trend is urbanization. It's been estimated that by the middle of this century, 70% of us will live in urban areas. And there are lots of consequences to that. We're concentrating some of the ecological pollution problems we think about. We certainly have not designed cities to be as sustainable as they ought to be if we're going to put as many of ourselves in them as we are. But to me, it's the sociological phenomenon, the fact that more and more young people are growing up in urban environments divorced from nature, and yet we're faced as a society with making some of the most consequential and irreversible decisions about the future of the environment. And most of the citizenry is not going to feel that personal, visceral connection with nature that's necessary to make the right decisions and in some cases the right sacrifices to do what we ought to do to save the environment. And there's the political dimension. There is such political polarization over major environmental issues that it results in gridlock. There's always a danger of making the wrong decision. We're in danger of making no decisions that we ought to be making, and yet the problems continue to grow and become ever more threatening. And Tom mentioned my personal background as a scientist is in the study of species. I focus on insects, but interested in species discovery in general. And there's a best-selling book, and if you haven't read it, it's a great read. Elizabeth Colbert has it. It's called The Sixth Extinction. And she pulls together a lot of the evidence to suggest not only is there a threat of a sixth extinction on this planet, it's already happening. We're on the slippery slope going there. And to put that in perspective, the last time there have been five previous episodes in the history of this planet when 70% or more of all the living things disappeared. The last time was 65 million years ago when the Alvarez asteroid hit the Gulf of Mexico. And that, of course, is when the large dinosaurs famously disappeared, along with a great number of other species. And so humans, you know, weren't even a thought yet at that point. So there is absolutely nothing in our history to prepare us for the dimensions of the loss of 70% or more of the species on the planet. And to put our level of ignorance in perspective, in the last 250 years, we have discovered and described fewer than 2 million species. We estimate there are 12 million living species. So we have fractional knowledge of what's there. They are literally going extinct faster than we can discover them and learn what we ought to learn from them. And to me, this is one of the most frightening specters. But with all these new challenges that are so large and so complex, we're left with universities that were designed in a different time for a different set of problem solving. And the model of the research university in America in the 20th century was so successful. I mean, an amazing success story. The creation of ideas and new technologies and new materials and new ways of doing things really underpinned the great economic success of this country and of Western Europe. But against these new challenges, these institutions are ill-formed to deal with them as efficiently as we like. If you look at the modern university, it's evolved for excellence in increasingly narrow specializations. So it's very rare that a faculty member, say in an engineering school on a campus, spends time talking to a biologist or to a historian. And the original purpose of the university, of course, 900 years ago when we formed them, and the word university, it was really the universe of human knowledge, the universe of everything we know in one place. And the great advantage is that you could have all that knowledge interacting in a synergistic way and producing a better outcome than you could with isolated disciplines. And then ironically, and in science, it's because we were thinking reductionistically. We were thinking that if you take a complex problem and devolve it into its constituent pieces, understand and solve each of those pieces, then it's just a matter of putting it back together and problem solved. Turns out it's not that simple. There are emergent properties and complex systems that can't be predicted from the pieces. And reductionism proves inadequate for the kinds of environmental challenges we're facing. Even if we came up with a sustainable, renewable, powerful source of energy today, unless we work with sociologists to make sure that the public understands and adopts that technology, the problem's not solved. And so these really complex things have to bring together the science and technology, the political will, the understanding of what people value, what guides their decision-making. All those things need to come together if we're going to be successful, and on a very short timetable. So in short, we need a different kind of institution if we're going to successfully confront these problems. Something that poor Tom has heard dozens of times, I fear, is a quote from E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist. And in his book, Consilience, and this has been a major formative thing in my thinking about what we ought to do, he says that historians of science often tell you that getting the right answer is far less important than asking the right question. And as he puts it, if you ask a trivial question, you also get a trivial answer. But if you ask the right question, even if it's not even answerable in exact form, it will lead you to major discoveries. So what we're asking ourselves at ESF is, what are the right questions for ESF? Given our history, our traditions, our strengths, what are those questions we can ask that will lead us to major discoveries that will help society confront some of these problems? And we've sort of zeroed in on four questions that we think we're uniquely positioned to play a role in seeking answers. All are too complex to answer with any certainty, but I'm confident each will lead us to major insights that we need. The first is asking, what are the relationships between humans and the natural world, between humans and our environments, both built and natural? And this involves bringing science to humanity, reaching out, informing the electorate of the issues that are at stake, the data behind it, the best recommendations from science for a path forward, and trying to move society in those directions. It also involves bringing humanity to science. Science often has operated in the ivory tower, isolated, not listening necessarily to the needs of humanity, and sometimes not being our best selves because we're not bringing humanitarian thought into science. The second question is a very fundamental one. What are Earth's species and dynamics? And we flatter ourselves that we understand the biosphere much better than we do. I've already mentioned that we know less than 20% of the moving parts of the biosphere. That should give you pause. If I gave you a watch to repair and you only knew what 20 of the 100 parts in it did, I wouldn't expect it to be ticking well when I got it back. And yet that's where we are. We're really flying blind. And it's not much better in ecology or ecosystem science, where we're just beginning to understand those emergent properties of these incredibly finely tuned complex systems. So we need to really invest in fundamental curiosity-driven research to better understand what are the moving parts in the biosphere, what does each contribute to the whole, and how does this whole dynamic biosphere work. We talk about climate change, and of course the whole history of the planet has been climate change. It's only a question of scale, of pace, how quickly climate is changing. You know, we've evolved as a species, and certainly civilization has arisen in an unusual sweet spot in the climate. If you look back at the Pleistocene, the cycles of major glaciation and interglacials shows just how wildly climate varies over relatively short periods of thousands of years. And it just hasn't been within our experience to think about and prepare for that. The third question is, how can we sustainably design, manage, and conserve resources and environments, again, both built and natural? And this is the practical, everyday, how we deal with environmental problems and with our environments. And this is something that ESF has done from the time it opened its doors. When the college was created as the College of Forestry in 1911, forest cover in New York State, due to poor management, had been reduced by about 3/4. Now, a century later, due to the sustainable practices that ESF and other organizations brought to New York State, the forests have rebounded. We enjoy an amazing amount of forest cover. I think it's approximately 65% of the state now. And that's a remarkable story of success. But we need to be doing the same thing across the board in our environmental needs. And then we flatter ourselves, too, that we're more in charge of the world than we are as this one recently evolved species. And while we should try to mitigate the impacts of things like climate change, I think we should be humbled before the forces of nature and realize that there's a limited amount that we can actually do to change the course of these things. And it would be wise, therefore, to spend a lot of time thinking about, instead of how do we stop or seriously mitigate or reverse such patterns, how do we adapt to them? How do we forecast them more precisely? How do we predict and anticipate their impacts? And how do we adapt the way we do things so that it's efficient in that new reality that's probably coming regardless of what else we do? So all of this leads us to begin to reimagine ESF. How can we build ESF forward in a way that it lives up to these new challenges? And if this weren't difficult enough, we find ourselves in an environment where suddenly the world has woken up and discovered environmental issues. And so if there was a college or university 20 years ago who didn't have a school, a department, a program in sustainability or in environmental biology, they almost certainly do now. So there's a proliferation of these things that are now our competitors. We wish them success because no single institution can solve these problems. We need as many players as we can. But at the same time, they are competitors for the best faculty, the best students, and for investors and donors of vision who get what's at stake here and want to be part of the solution. So we have to find some way to rise above the weeds, differentiate ESF, and give people reasons to want to partner with us. There I find myself in a fantastically enviable place. ESF has enormous strengths on which to build this new vision for the future. We have strength in management and utilization of natural resources. We were doing sustainability decades before that word existed. We have a history of design of sustainable landscapes, processes, and solutions to practical problems, a history of bringing fundamental science and practical problem solving together, and a wide range of research and scholarship activities that have led to many, many important discoveries. And it's been a fabulous education institution, producing leaders in environmental thinking and biology, and reaching very effectively out to the public. The institution, it's part of the culture to share what we know with the wider public and not just our students. We're also building on a rising reputation. If you look at the rankings for colleges and universities in the last 2 or 3 years, it's amazing what this small institution is doing in terms of those rankings, and I'll brag about a few. U.S. News and World Report rank us in the top 30 colleges and universities. Huffington Post ranks us among the top 100 most collaborative colleges. So it's already recognized that we're working across those disciplinary lines. The Washington Monthly ranks us in the top 100 universities that for public good, the top 10 universities for the best bang for the buck, and number 6 in the country for student participation in community service. Last year, ESF students volunteered more than 70,000 hours. And keep in mind that this is a population of about 1,700 students. So that is remarkable engagement. Forbes ranks ESF 20th nationwide in the best value universities, and importantly, number 3 in the country for women majoring in STEM fields, in science, technology, engineering, and math. Princeton Review recently ranked us in the top 379 best colleges in the country, the 200 best value colleges, and the top 10 colleges for making an impact on society. And so these are, you know, it's a wonderful place to begin from. And so let's talk a little bit about this reimagining ESF. And we're early in the process. We're engaged in unsettling strategic planning. We've suddenly thrown everything into question, how we're organized, how we work, what priorities we'll have in the next 5 and 10 years. But these considerations are being guided by a series of what I call design imperatives, things that I think are so important to the success of ESF and the success of institutions like ours in addressing environmental problems that they have to be taken into account as we reconceive ourselves going forward. The first is derived from Ed Wilson's book, Consilience, and I would call it disciplinary consilience. And in science, when we say consilience, what we mean is looking at several independent lines of evidence, all of which converge upon a deep understanding or a deeper solution to a problem. And so this involves bringing those disciplines together, tearing down the silos that have isolated them for the last century, and rethinking how we interact with each other on campus and with our colleagues beyond campus. This involves a second design imperative, which is collaboration. And you can't achieve that transdisciplinary work without meaningful collaboration. But that has to start at the top. And what I'm working toward is a roundtable leadership model for ESF that has the critical leadership sitting around the table, collectively making better decisions than certainly I can alone, and I presume my colleagues alone. But that's only the leadership. We then have to have the ability to encourage and enable and create opportunities for the talking of faculty and students and staff across the discipline. So a new building that we're working on, the Academic Research Building, which will be situated, if you know our campus, in the corner between Illick and Bray, will be a new research building with state-of-the-art laboratories. But on the first floor, we're designing something we call a collaboratory, a space that welcomes people from any discipline to come together and talk about and tackle common problems. It's critical, with a design imperative number 3, that we manage to do 2 things that are somewhat contradictory. One is focus, and the other is agility. We do so many things, and we do each well, But at this point in time, ESF doesn't have the depth in areas to make the level of contribution that we're capable of. So we're going to pick a small number of areas to invest in critical mass of faculty and students so that we can contribute on a larger scale. But at the same time, we don't want to lose one of the advantages of being a small institution, which is agility. We're capable of turning on a dime. So if a need suddenly arises, we can respond to it. And we don't want to lose that very special nimbleness that lets us do that. Another design imperative is entrepreneurial thinking, entrepreneurial spirit. And I mean this in two senses. In the traditional sense of fundraising, we are finding our sea legs. Neil Murphy, at the centennial of the college, launched its first capital campaign. And Neil set this up in a beautiful way, so beautiful, in fact, that as of the end of December, the campaign closed a year and a half early and $1.5 million over budget. So we raised about $21.5 million, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And it tells me that the mission of ESF is recognized and appreciated broadly, and again, something strong to build on. The other thing we did recently, which was really gratifying, was our first experiment with using social media for fundraising. And you probably all have heard our great story about saving the American chestnut. We now have a blight-resistant, genetically modified chestnut that means that your children, and maybe more likely grandchildren, will see the great forests more like they used to be in eastern North America. Chestnuts were about one out of every four trees in the eastern forest before the blight hit. And so restoring that is just a phenomenal achievement. But at the point of the technical success, we now move into the practical phase, which is you have to propagate these things. We do not yet have permission to release them in the wild, but while we're going through the regulatory process, it's a time to propagate seedlings so that when they're legal to release, we're ready to go. So this social media campaign was 1 month with a goal of raising $50,000 that would allow the ESF team to cultivate 10,000 of these resistant chestnut trees. Well, 30 days later, not only have we raised the $50,000, we had raised over $100,000. And more importantly, 68% of the donors were people with no prior connection with ESF. So what we're doing resonates widely with the public. And these were from many states and internationally. But there's a more important part of entrepreneurial thing, even than raising the money, although that's a very important part. The other part is intellectual entrepreneurism. We make incredible discoveries. The chestnut's a perfect example. But solving the problem is one thing. Making the public aware of that is another. So we need to become better and make it part of our culture on campus to squeeze every bit of media attention, every bit of recognition for these achievements that we can. And sometimes academics are sort of self-effacing, and we gauge ourselves against our colleagues. You know, how well do we do publishing papers or bringing in grants? And again, this is what happens within the ivory tower. But if you think about being a true entrepreneur of ideas, you want to take those ideas out and spread them as widely as possible. And I'll give one example of my personal experience that I'm now looking for ways to enact at ESF across the board. And I have a couple dozen ideas of comparable things we could do. And this is an annual list that we released called the Top 10 New Species. And every year about 18,000 species are discovered, named, described, put on a library shelf, and the public is totally unaware of this. And naively, I thought this was so exciting that if I just shared the data with reporters, we'd get press. So I made these beautiful pie charts with how many species were plants and how many were bugs each year. Nothing. No interest whatsoever. And but then I came on the idea of making a top 10 list. And you would not believe the press coverage. We get, you know, National Geographic, Discover Magazine, New York Times, every year, and we actually get contacted months in advance saying, when is it? And And when it is actually on or about May 23rd, which you all should keep in mind is Linnaeus's birthday. And Linnaeus was a Swedish botanist who invented the modern system of naming things. He's actually on one of the dollar bills in Sweden. They know how to honor scientists. And but we're hoping to do some poetic justice to Linnaeus by doing this on his birthday. But to quantify the media impact, our websites at ESF get about 10,000 views a day. And it bounces along, a little high, a little low, but about 10,000 a day. Had never broken through the 10,000 views in any single 24-hour period. When we released the top 10 list for the first time from ESF last year, we had over 165,000 views in 24 hours. And so it's a whole new level of visibility of ESF. Now, if we can do this for two dozen of our activities across the college, then people begin to take note. Another design imperative is to recognize the communities we're embedded in, take advantage of that, and live up to our responsibility to improve those communities the best we can. And I like to think of a sustainability triangle with Syracuse, the Adirondacks, and New York City. We are in an enviable position where Syracuse is a perfect model city for rethinking how we design and build cities to be more sustainable, more green, more pleasant to live in, more efficient in operation. Onondaga Lake, you couldn't ask for a better example. You know, students will study Onondaga Lake and its story for generations in textbooks. It's one of the greatest restoration ecology stories ever told. We're right in the middle of it. No one knows exactly how that story ends, but regardless, it's a fascinating and important one. And ESF has been active in that and will be going forward, using it as a case study. We want to have a larger footprint in New York City for really two fundamental reasons. Most institutions spend a lot of energy, a lot of resources competing for an inadequate number of minority students. We all want to see the workforce reflect society at large so that it's inclusive, so that people buy in to the problems and are part of the solution. But rather than competing for this demographic, which is impossibly small and hard for any institution to make progress on a short scale, we want to take the long-term view and invest our energies reaching out to youngsters in New York City and in Syracuse and try to awaken that curiosity and love of nature that will lead them to, some of them, some percentage, into careers in science. But it's an investment that won't pay off for decades, but it's the right thing to do socially. And then, of course, the Adirondacks are America's wilderness, and they're located near the largest population concentration on the continent. And so I can't think of a better place to do the kind of research, outuse, study of the relationship between humans and nature. That is ground zero for doing that. And we're so fortunate to have about 25,000 acres of experimental forests and other facilities that we use. The next design imperative is designing a campus which is diverse and tolerant. And we all talk about diversity, we all talk about tolerance, but what do we actually do on a day-to-day basis to enact that? And the university at its best is a place where all ideas are welcomed, where reasoned discourse can take place even among people with diametrically opposed views. But this doesn't always happen, and there's a danger at a place like ESF because it's small and because most of us were drawn there because we already love the environment and want to do that, to sort of reinforce each other's views. And it's critical, as part of the definition of diversity, that we bring in other views from society and confront those. They're as legitimate as our own, and they're shaping public opinion, and we need to deal with that. So one way we're enacting that is to try to model for our students what respectful discourse looks like. So we've started a series of events that we hold in Moon Library that we call Moonlighting, and we bring together people to have these difficult discussions. Last year we were talking about resurrecting the dead, which we meant really the examples like the American chestnut, or more importantly, people who are trying to literally bring back extinct species, the passenger pigeon, the woolly mammoth. There are people seriously working to bring these things back, and it's kind of a Jurassic Park scenario, and the ethical questions involved are profound, and it's something we need to talk about. Next month, we're going to have, I'm really looking forward to this, the next moonlighting is going to be Father Fred Coyne from Lemoyne, who for many years was the lead astronomer for the Vatican's observatory. And so he combines his religious faith with leading edge science. And Warren Ullman, who's director of the Museum of the Earth in Ithaca, and Warren has written a book on evolution versus creation. And so between the two of them, I'm expecting, I don't know what to expect, but except it'll be an enjoyable evening. Design imperative 7 is curiosity. We face so many problems that we could be excused if we put every position we have, every dollar we have, into solving the incredibly pressing problems we face. But even if we put the sum total of the GDP of the U.S. into these problems, they're too great, too numerous, we couldn't solve them all. More importantly, we would paint ourselves into a corner. It's the fundamental curiosity-driven research that stumbles on possibilities we couldn't even imagine. And it's by those fundamental discoveries that we create new opportunities to solve problems better and more efficiently. And universities are one of the few places in society with the luxury of doing research which is not directed at solving an immediate problem, but expanding our sum total knowledge. And we can't lose sight of that because subsequent generations will rely on what we've discovered to solve their most immediate and pressing problems. So that has to stay at the forefront. One expression of that for us is the Roosevelt Wildlife Station. And I sadly didn't know about the Roosevelt Wildlife Station before I arrived, and I can't believe that. It is a phenomenal organization. It was set up just months after Teddy Roosevelt died in 1919, intended to be a suitable memorial for this person who personified the best of conservation philosophy, who established the National Park System. It was the only conservation organization of any kind, institution, that had Teddy's personal blessing. The idea had been floated in the Boone and Crockett Club with Teddy. His response was that it was a brilliant idea and it should be done big. And we're now picking up on Teddy's advice and we're going to do it bigger than we have and make it far more conspicuous. And our faculty have developed a 5-year strategic plan for the station, which is fabulous. It's visionary. You'll all be hearing amazing things out of the Roosevelt Wildlife Station as we go ahead. But we're so blessed to have that connection with Teddy, that identity with the college. Design Imperative 8 is the antithesis of what I just told you. While that fundamental research is essential, it's also essential that we actually solve problems. And so the other design imperative is that we also focus on relevant and impactful work. And I'll mention two examples. Just within the last few months, two of the most amazing conservation success stories ever hit the press, and they both were led by ESF faculty. One I've already mentioned, the American chestnut. There's never been a story of using genetic engineering technology to such a massively important and successful end. The other one is on a much smaller geographic scale. There's an island, one of the islands in the Galapagos, Pinzon Island, had the saddleback variety of the giant tortoises that we've probably all seen pictures of from the Galapagos. But that island has not seen the birth of one of these tortoises in 150 years. They were hunted to extinction by sailors and pirates. They apparently made great soup and lots of it. And also rats had been introduced by the sailors to the island, and they would kill off the young before they had a chance to grow up, so they had been completely exterminated from the island. Just within the last few months, for the first time, James Gibbs, one of our professors, has evidence now that they are reproducing on Pinzon, the young are surviving, and they're well on their way back to establishment. So you'll be able to visit that island, see something that hasn't been seen for a century and a half. The other practical thing that I'm really excited about, because it combines my passion for species exploration with this urgent need to solve problems. And if you read about biomimicry, it's often described as a new science. But I'm here to tell you, ESF's been doing biomimicry from the time it opened the doors. When our landscape architects use what we've learned about ecosystems to design landscapes that are in sync with the cycles of the planet, that's biomimicry. When our bioprocess engineers find a more efficient way to break down wood products using the same chemical pathways that fungi use to break down wood, that's biomimicry. And it's hard for me to even think of much we do at ESF that isn't biomimicry, and yet it's never been called that. It's yet to be recognized as such. And so biomimicry is a hot, sexy topic at the moment. And there are institutions popping up everywhere doing biomimicry. Small institutions like the University of Akron have a biomimicry program now. Harvard's largest single donation was a $125 million gift recently that set up an institute for biomimetic engineering. MIT has a biomimetic robotics lab. They're all over the country. They share one thing in common. They're taking the little bit of knowledge we have about just a handful of those 2 million species we've discovered and milking those for models for better designs, better processes, better materials, more sustainable, more cheap to produce, more enduring. And so they're making that translation from this tiny, tiny percentage of the models into successful new products that are incredibly exciting. But given the fact that 80% of the species on Earth aren't known at all, that probably well over 90% of the species we do know, we have not made what we know about them accessible to engineers, to entrepreneurs, to inventors, to designers to come up with these new products. The odds that we're getting the best models is almost zero. And so if you look at the bottlenecks for biomimetics, there are two. First is simply getting out there and finding out how plants and animals have solved in sustainable fashion their ability to survive and overcome the challenges of survival. And those, by the way, are exactly the same challenges we're facing. Everyone needs energy, everyone needs food. It's all the same problems. And the answers are there. Among those 12 million species are literally billions of clues about better ways of doing things than we do them now. But they're going extinct faster than we're discovering them. Almost all leave no fossil record behind. So every species that disappears was a chance to discover a better way of doing something that'll never be retrievable. And so it's now or never that we document this. The second bottleneck is just accessing that information. The scientists who describe nature, the natural historians, do it in tortured jargon that no one can understand except another handful of experts. And then they publish it in journals that no one reads, that go into the library and are buried. We need to rethink how we describe them in terms understandable to anyone trying to solve a problem, and how we use modern informatics to make searching and finding those answers better. And I'll mention just one example of biomimicry to give you an idea, but there are literally hundreds, and maybe I'll mention two. One is in Japan. They built the world's fastest train, over 200 miles an hour. However, it went so fast that when it went through a tunnel, it would create a sonic boom as it pushed the air out of the tunnel as it exited. And it was, you know, shaking dishes a quarter of a mile away, this boom, so they had to do something about it. And the chief engineer working on the train happened to be an amateur ornithologist. He was a bird watcher. And he noticed that kingfishers, when they dive to feed, go from two densities of media from the air into the water, making almost no splash at all. The shape of the beak penetrates the water, and it's seamless straight in. So he redesigned the front of the train to mimic the beak of the bird. Problem solved. No more boom. Penetrated the new density of air as it came out of the tunnel effortlessly. Another example is in Zimbabwe, where there's an office building. And the architects, I don't know how they made the connection, but I like it because it's entomological. Somehow they got on to termite nests in Australia. And these nests passively are constructed by the termites in such a way that the passive movement of air conditions them. And the temperature in that nest, even though the ambient temperature outside varies by, I don't remember the exact amount, but probably 15 or 20 degrees, it varies no more than 2 degrees within the nest. And so this architect took the principles from the termites, built this building. It uses 90% less energy than a comparable sized office building to cool itself. And it's that simple. And those are just two examples. There are literally billions of them if we deal with it. And I'm almost done. I'm only 10 of these things. Design imperative 9 is the need for a different approach to environmentalism. I already mentioned the political impasse. And I'll just mention that we've created a new center that we call the Center for a New American Environmentalism. And our ambitious goal is to bridge the gaps, to bring the political extremes together, to overcome those differences, to recast environmentalism so that it is based on objective science that everyone can trust. It is based on our values as a society. We need to examine those values. How do we want to act, and how do we want future generations to remember us? And it needs to include all voices in environmentalism and not these factions and camps we have now. So it's an ambitious undertaking, but something that has to be done. And then the final one is risk-taking. We want to create a culture where we're comfortable taking risk, and where faculty are not afraid that if they take a risk, might be a career ender. You have to have a culture in which it's recognized that if you do bold, interesting, highly potentially successful things, they're likely to fail. And we need a culture that celebrates that and says it's okay to fail. Now just try again. And if you keep doing that, you'll eventually get to success. And I'll conclude with a quote from Mark Zuckerberg, who said, in a world changing really quickly, the only strategy that's guaranteed to fail is not taking risk. And I think we have to take that to heart. We're in a situation where there's maybe no greater threat to our survival than the status quo. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wheeler.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, questions?
Absolutely, and I'm going to spot them. Actually, I have one. You mentioned a few times that there have been 2 million species discovered, maybe about 18,000 get discovered a year. And I understand that you had taken a part in that and that you have discovered about 100 new species. And you've had 3 new species named in your honor, but I have no clue what those are.
Oh, all right.
Give us a clue. Or what's your favorite new species?
That's not where I thought you were going.
Okay.
they're fairly obscure. One is a slime mold feeding beetle, which is a group called round fungus beetles that I spent 20 years working on. There's one of the 3 or 4 experts in the world who could recognize one of these things is in Italy, and he named one in my honor. And then one of my former students named a predaceous diving beetle after me. I honestly can't remember the third offhand, but where I thought you were going is, when I was living in London working at the Natural History Museum, that same student who named the diving beetle after me, I was paying him as a postdoc to keep my lab going. And we ended up naming three, when you said 3 species, this is where I thought you were going. We named 3 species after George W. Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. So there's Agathidium Bushi, Agathidium Cheneyi, and so forth. And while I was in London, I got a call one day. My secretary said the White House is on the phone, and this had hit the press. And I don't know if you know, on CNN, there's that woman, can't think of her first name, but Mui, who, she does all the man bites dog stories. She called like 6 times, and I would not take her call because I get enough ridicule without stepping into it, so I avoided that. But you can't not take a call from the White House. And so I thought their press office was hearing all this media coverage it was getting and was asking, what's the story? Mm-hmm. So I pick up the phone expecting that. Instead, I hear this lovely female voice that says, Professor Wheeler, and I said, yes, please hold for the president. And you're sitting there thinking, couldn't be, you know. Next voice would have been recognizable to any of us. George W. talked for about 5 minutes, thanked me for the honor. He had just learned at cabinet meeting that morning. And then I also got a note from Don Rumsfeld. And it's just a short sort of one-sentence thing thanking me. and it's signed. But then a handwritten P.S. at the bottom, and he says, P.S., this is a first for me, with a big exclamation mark. And you could just see him laughing at this idea of a beetle. But that was the other shameless self-promotion, in addition to the top 10. And so since, I have actually named other species after celebrities, just to shamelessly get media coverage. And it works.
Brilliant. I think I'm going to hire you to do my media.
Quentin, I want to ask a question about the curriculum and the student experience. The student arrives, the ones I've talked to, when they get there, I'm going to be in landscape architecture, or I'm going to learn how to make paper. And are you taking the required courses in a direction that will maybe help them make a decision? Maybe they'll stay for a master's degree, maybe they'll go on for a doctorate. And is there within that framework something in the back of your mind that you think all the graduates of ESF should know to be knowledgeable and go out into the world as graduates of ESF?
Yeah. The answer is yes, but I'm trying to restrain myself, because as a student, I would not want you or anyone else telling me what I needed, what to take. I'd like the ability to explore my own passions and interests, and I'm very appreciative of that, and I want to protect that. But on the other hand, there are things that I think everyone should know. I don't think anyone who's a scientist should get out without at least an introductory course in the philosophy of science. There are very few PhDs in biology today who've ever had a philosophy course. And I think that's dangerous, because everything we know, I mean, the difference between what we know and what we might believe or think we know, those are hugely different. So I'd like our students as environmental leaders all to appreciate that. Another thing I'd like them all to have is, but again, this is a personal decision. Where's your comfort? But be explicit about the decision, which is the line between science and advocacy or activism. And there's a place in the world for all those. But if you mix them all together and you don't have in your mind where the clear line is, that is a danger. And nothing scares me more. And the inspiration for the Center for New American Environmentalism is the fact that a lot of people now don't trust science. It's like, help me out. Who's the discredited news anchor in the news this week? Yeah, Brian. It's like Brian Williams. Once you lose that trust, it's maybe impossible to get back. And yet there is a growing number of people who seriously believe that the books are being cooked on global climate change. Once you lose the trust of science, we might as well be out of business. It's just open to anyone's opinion. And that's why we have to bring back objectivity. Science belongs to everyone. It should be fact-based. It should be explicit. It should be testable. And it should belong to people to argue on either side of an issue. But the facts shouldn't be a matter of opinion. And we've got to produce leaders who take that out into society.
The relationship at Cornell with the state side and the private side has always been highly integrated. And it was always been my impression that was true of ESF and Syracuse University. The absence of any comment to that on your presentation leads me to ask, what is the relationship, the current relationship?
We're working on that at the moment. it is a fascinating relationship, because from the time we opened our doors in 1911, it was in a Syracuse University building. And we have been integral ever since. Even when we joined the State University of New York in 1948, our students were living in Syracuse dorms, eating Syracuse food. They're still eating Syracuse food, by the way. But we are in the process of renegotiating the MOU, that's the exchange of services. One thing I did when I arrived, I was curious to know, when did the divorce happen? Legally, when did the divorce? So, we enlisted help in Albany, pawing through the archives and digging through everything we could find in Bray Hall. And to my amazement, we were never married. We've been living in sin since 1911. And there was no divorce, because there was never an official thing. And so it was always sort of a handshake, an understanding, a collegial relationship. And the reality is, this thing, was allowed to perpetuate itself for 100 years. SUNY, by no fault of its own, because this was working so well, never made the investments in our campus so that we had residence halls, we had dining halls, we had all the things other SUNY campuses have. But technically, legally, on paper, never was part of Syracuse University, which I find amazing. And probably more amazing for those of you who graduated a few years ago and actually have diplomas from both. So, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? It's an amazing thing. But we are in negotiations. We are redefining the relationship. We're trying to protect what is most valuable in that relationship, which is the academic exchange and the social exchange between the students. We are looking at other things, the ways that we deliver health services to our students, for example. There may be more cost-effective alternatives open to us, and we're exploring those at the moment. But we're trying to protect the really important relationship between these sister institutions. But as the Chancellor of SUNY reminds me, we are not Syracuse University. I can assure you of that.
Thank you for your compelling presentation. Mindful of asking the right question, I wonder if you'd comment on your vision. You talked a lot about collaboration. I was hearing that more in the context of Environmental Sciences College. I'm thinking of Syracuse University, the College of Arts and Sciences. I'm thinking of the Earth Science Program. I'm thinking of the Engineering School. I'm thinking of Lemoyne and some of the special programs. What is your vision, since we can't do this all in a closed circle?
Right.
What is your vision for how you will connect to places, not what you're doing now, because I'm sure you're doing some things, but in the future? I saw Dr. Eastwood here. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, thank you for that, and that is a fabulous question. And the vision is to be as collaborative as possible. We're small. Geographically, spatially, we can only grow so much. So we can never have the full range of expertise we need to achieve the big things we want to tackle. So it's not even a choice. It's a necessity that we form those partnerships. Syracuse has fantastic brain trust that we need to be part of. But we need to reach out to whoever can bring the appropriate expertise to let us do a better job. And one mechanism that I'm thinking of is creating, it doesn't have an official name yet, but an ESF Academy of Fellows, and to appoint experts from the real world, from the ivory tower, from our sister institutions around the state, around the country, to bring whatever expertise we need in and have them join these transdisciplinary teams to help us do a better job. And once we get through the current negotiations, which are really taking care of student services, it's a very business-like transaction, and that's working forward in good faith on both sides, and we'll solve those problems. I'm really looking forward to building more of the successful collaborations, of which there are several already, but I'd like to see a lot more. And so I hope collaboration is written large in that sense.
Okay, thank you.
Morning.
Hi.
I applaud your idea of igniting the interest of students in the urban cities, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about exactly what it is you're doing, and also if whether you have formed perhaps any partnerships, such as with Baltimore Woods has a wonderful program called Nature in the City, and it would seem like that would be a great partnership for that would be beneficial to the students and great for both of you.
Right, absolutely. No, and this gets back to the partnerships. We are looking for partners in the city to work with. I've been a research associate at the American Museum in New York since the early 80s and have many friends there, and some of my former students are scientists there now. And the American Museum obviously does a great job of this. But we're interested in bringing the sort of outdoor experience into the city. And these are all very early formative ideas. I can't point to any successes yet. We do have a snappy acronym, which, depending on your perspective, is either fortunate or obscene, which is, see if I can do it, Sustainability Education and Citizen Science in the City, which will be a collection of activities to introduce natural history to students and awaken that connection with nature. But the acronym is Sex in the City, SECS. So. So we've got that media grabbing acronym. We now just need the programs behind it, and those aren't formulated yet.
All right. On that note, thank you, Dr. Wheeler, for being with us today. I hope you'll join us again.
I did. Thank you very much.